And as we look at our text tonight, it's kind of interesting because we see kind of a change and a pretty radical change in the history of Israel. And they have a very young history because Israel is, you know, still alive and his 12 sons have been born to him. And now as he kind of passes the baton, and we saw that last time as he kind of prophesied over each one of his sons, you know, he's basically saying, hey, this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to befall you in the last days. And he prophesied over each of his sons. And now it's going to shift from that patriarch Jacob or Israel, who's been kind of the pillar of the family and the one who's kind of controlling everything, to him passing off the scene and then everything passing forward to his 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. And then, of course, Joseph being kind of the predominant one there because of his position in the land of Egypt. Now, it's interesting because for years, and I don't know if you've ever watched Discovery Channel or Nova or any of those shows where they talk about the children of Israel and how they never were really in Egypt and that never really happened, and there's no archaeological evidence that any of it took place in the time of Ramses, and they've done excavations and they know that in the time of Ramses there was no exodus from Egypt. And we talked about that when we covered that, you know, talked about they built in the area of Ramses. Well, that's one of those things, and I mentioned this, but you probably didn't catch the importance of it, but it's one of those things where in a later date when things are being copied down, maybe that was added in there to say, it's talking about, when it talks about Goshen, the Fertile Delta, it's talking about the city of Ramses. That's the location of the city that the children of Israel lived in, but Ramses was built much later. In fact, during the dynasty of Ramses, they have a stela that's sitting there in Egypt, and it's called the Israel stela. And the reason it is because it mentions the nation of Israel. In the bottom of it, it's basically talking about the conquests of that pharaoh Ramses and how he had attacked Israel, the peoples of Israel. And that's interesting because if Ramses had attacked the peoples of Israel, that means that Israel was a nation already by the time that he attacked them. So when did this take place? Well, that's been the big confusion. And that's why when archaeologists go to Egypt, they don't find anything in terms of evidence in that era of Ramses, which was probably about 1200 BC, somewhere in there. But rather, the exodus happened much earlier than that. And they lived in a city called Avaris, which was in the Fertile Delta. That was one of the cities of the Israelites, Avaris. And the archaeology of that area and that dig is huge. It's Semitic peoples who have Semitic type Canaanite houses that they've built, you know, at least the type of Canaanite houses that the Israel built when they went into Canaan. And they were shepherds, and I mean, everything fits. And also, not only that, they were wealthy and preferred. And then as you look through the archaeology and the graves that were after that, they were deficient and mistreated. And then as you move forward in history, they vanished, leaving everything behind. Just in an instant. And it's just the archaeology is amazing. So Avaris was the capital city of the place where Joseph lived. This is where this is where Jacob would have lived. And as Jacob died, it seems from what we can tell from the archaeology that they built a castle, if you will, right on the place of Joseph's house. They took Israel's house down, which was a nice house, but they built a castle in the site of it. They put up colonnades and pillars. Actually, it's interesting because the way that the castle is built is there's 12 pillars in it, in this portico. And then outside, guess what they have outside in the backyard? 12 tombs, 12 very distinct tombs. And yet one stands out from all the other tombs. All the other tombs are dome-type tombs. And one is a pyramid. And in that pyramid is a statue of a man that's twice the size of a normal human, with yellow skin and red hair and a coat of many colors, who sits upon this statue. And in that tomb, there are no bones. Interesting, as we're going to see here. But we're going to actually, next week, I think we're going to watch a video next week about this whole thing. and kind of get us into the mood of the Exodus, but we're not going to go right into Exodus. We're going to do the end starting in December. So, and that's going to be a study in the end times, and that starts in December. So encourage you to come for that. But for now, we're just going to finish up the book of Genesis tonight. And so in verse 49, it says, when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, chapter 49, verse 33, commanding his sons, he drew his feet into his bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. And so Jacob, or Israel, had lost his son at probably the age of 17, didn't see him for at least 13 years, no, actually longer than that, 15 years, somewhere in there, and then was able to spend the last 17 years of Jacob and Joseph's lives together. You know, when before Jacob would die, he got to spend another 17 years with his son. And so very precious, you know, to think you've lost somebody and then to find out they're still alive and then to be able to rekindle that relationship. And so there was a special bond between Jacob and Israel. I mean, Israel and Joseph. I get these confused. Again, I didn't get any sleep last night, so if I say crazy things tonight, then that's why. But it says in verse 1, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And this had to be very difficult for Joseph. You know, his father, who he was favored by as a young man, and then all that lost time, and probably in a place in his life where he has a lot of responsibility. You know, as Jacob and all of his children and everybody moves to Egypt, you know, Joseph's in a place where he has a lot of responsibility, and so the time that he gets to spend with his father is probably not super productive, and probably some awkwardness there. You know, I was noticing that today, just talking to some guys about their fathers, and I don't know what it is about young men and their dads and why there's tension, but it just seems like there always is. I don't know why. Jeremiah was saying, well, I think men, you know, it's just two different men, you know, it's just men, you know, it's the problem. But just this older man now and his father and trying to work things out, and now he's passed on. And I think that was a pretty big deal. So it says, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And so it just had to be a very difficult loss. And probably wish that he could have spent more time with his father. But notice verse 2, it said, and Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father, so the physicians embalmed Israel. Now, this is interesting because it doesn't say that the priest did it. And that would have been typical. If you read the book of the Egyptian Book of the Dead and you look at their procedures, there was basically commending the people to the gods, and they had the priest did all these rituals and stuff. But instead of having the priest do it, which were the normal people who would embalm, he has his physicians do the embalming, because it's not to the gods of Egypt. It's to the God of Israel that he's commended. And so these guys, physicians, take him. They begin to do the embalming process. It tells us in verse 3, 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed, and the Egyptians would mourn for him 70 days. Now, the mourning would start, of course, at the moment he would die. And you'll notice in other places that they would mourn for Israelites, they'd mourn for them for 30 days oftentimes. And so it's very possible that they embalmed him. It usually would be a 10-day process to embalm, and then 30 days for the mourning process for the Israel. But it would seem probably here, whether it has become Joseph's culture or Pharaoh commanded it, he would require 70 days for all the Egyptians to mourn over this man. And that was a great honor. Now, most people who died in Egypt didn't get embalmed. You know, and you think about it, well, they're all mummies, right? No, only super wealthy people could do this. Now, if you were just a regular person, like an average person like you and me, they would just stick you out in the hot sun, surrounded by hot sand, and let you dry out. And, you know, and that was kind of the process. If you had some money, then they might anoint your body with oils and things like that. But the whole thing was, it was going to be, your body was being preserved for the afterlife. And so poor people were going to be poor and have a poor body in the afterlife. And the wealthy, they would take and they would, remove their organs. They put juniper juice in their body to shrink the organs and to, basically get the putrescence out of their skin, make their skin smell better. And then they have these crazy ways of extracting the brain through the nose and just all these different things that they did. And it was a very, very intense process to remove the organs, to fill you with fluids that would preserve your body. And then only usually pharaohs or kings or very, very wealthy people would actually be mummified, where they'd actually stick you and wrap you in a mummification and anoint that with oil. And they would bury you in a tomb with lots of different things. It's interesting that in Avaris, where they find even the Israelites being buried, they find them being buried with a lot of things like knives and tools and sometimes even goats and sheep, like that are buried in their tomb with them. And probably adopting that at that time, and they spent 400 years in Egypt, so probably adopting that from the Egyptians, thinking, I'm going to need these things in the afterlife. I'm going to take them with me, right? And so they'd bury them in the tomb. So they find in their tombs, their graves, all kinds of things like that, but not mummified and not bones. I mean, other than just bones in these graves. But anyway, so Joseph has him completely embalmed, and then Pharaoh would probably have been the one that called for mourning for 70 days, which is significant because when the Pharaoh died, the Egyptians would mourn for 72 days. And so just slightly below in honor and prestige would be Israel, Zaphnath-Paaneah, or Jake or Joseph's father. And so that was a pretty big deal. Now it says, verse 4, when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you will bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back." And so we see here Joseph honoring his father's wishes. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's interesting how we as humans find that to be important. I've done a lot of funerals in my time and gone through final arrangements with people and just talked to them about, what do you want? And sometimes, and this is kind of different, but sometimes people are sick and they have the ability to, they know they're going, and they have the ability to arrange their own funeral. And so I sit down with them and they say, this is the song I want. This is what I love that. I love it when people do that. And the reason I love that is because I can launch into this person was ready for their funeral. And then I move from they were ready. In fact, they had all the songs picked. They knew who they wanted to read poems and everything. And it all came together according to their wishes. But they also were ready because they knew Jesus, right? And I think that that's really the most important thing when it comes to a memorial service. But he has a specific desire. Remember, he made Joseph swear to him that he would not bury him in the land of Egypt, but that he would bury him in the land of Machpelah, or in Canaan, in Machpelah, where he bought the cave from the sons of Heth, that he would be buried in that plot. And in that plot was Abraham, was Sarah, was Rebekah and Isaac. And also, remember, that's where he buried Leah, his wife. It's interesting that he'd want to be buried there and not halfway between Bethel and Ephrathah, or Bethlehem, where Rachel was buried. But rather, he'd want to be buried with Leah and with his fathers. And significant that he'd want to be buried there. And maybe this is something we want to think about. But he says, I want to be buried in that place so that I can be with my people, with my ancestors. But more importantly, when the resurrection comes, he's going to wake up, not in Egypt, but in the promised land, you know, and that was important to him. You know, we talked about that a little bit, you know, how we always face everybody east because Jesus is coming that way. And you don't want to wake up the wrong direction. You know, like, what's going on? You know, they'll see it, but they do. They lay your head down facing front. So when Jesus comes, you're facing east when you stand up, you know, your head to the west facing east. And so, you know, you might want to think about that, but it doesn't matter. You know, honestly, when it comes to our, you know, everything, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, right? That's what it says. That's what God told Adam. You know, you're going to, from the dust you came, to dust you shall return. And that's the way that it is for everybody. So if you're going to be cremated, don't be freaked out by that. Somebody came up to me the other day and they said, I was listening to a pastor on the radio. It was a pastor that's like right before me or something like that. And he was saying that if you're cremated, that you won't go to heaven. I was like, what? Are you kidding me? That's ridiculous. But, you know, people have weird ideas about things. And you know, death is a scary thing, I think. You know, I think it's a scary thing for us to think of dying and, you know, what happens when we die. Now, as Christians, we have a hope, right? And we have our hope in Jesus. But, you know, honestly, it's an unknown. You know, you don't know what that's going to be like. What's it going to feel like? What's it going to be like? And I think we kind of have this idea of heaven like it's just some, you know, misty non-reality. But the reality is that this is more misty non-reality than that's going to be. That's when we're resurrected, that's going to be real, real, right? We're going to be experiencing things and dimensions and who knows what we're going to be able to perceive that we can't perceive here. So it's nothing to fear as a Christian, but it is important. And so he's buried there in Israel. Now, it was a guy that was once buried, or excuse me, he was in Israel, not buried, but he was in Israel on a trip with his wife and his mother-in-law. And his mother-in-law, during the trip, actually passed away. She died in Israel while they were in Israel. And so they went, you know, to the morgue or whatever, and the guy says, well, we have a couple options for you. You know, she, for $5,000, she could be buried right here in the Holy Land. And, you know, it's pretty inexpensive, and, you know, to think that you have a loved one buried in the Holy Land, you know. And he says, what's the other option? He said, well, it costs $50,000 to ship her home. And he says, I'll pay it, $50,000 to ship her home. And they're like, are you sure? You know, she could be buried in the Holy Land. And he said, you know, I heard that once a man was buried here and he rose from the dead, and I'm not taking any chances. But we all, it doesn't matter if it's in Israel or here, your mother-in-law is going to be resurrected. And it says, verse 6, and Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you swear. And so Pharaoh is very respectful of last wishes, which is great. And so Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went all the servants of Pharaoh. And so you got to all the servants of Pharaoh. Now, just think about that for a minute. All the servants of Pharaoh. Does that mean the whole cabinet? Everybody that's important? Every single person who's part of Pharaoh's court? You know, I mean, this could be quite the deal. The elders of his house and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as the house of Joseph, his brothers, his father's house, only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both the chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. And so we're talking possibly thousands of people in procession, a giant Egyptian procession going all the way up, a several day journey, going up to the land of Israel, or the land of Canaan at that time. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. And so just a huge deal, you know, going up there. And, you know, that's the way some funerals are. You know, I mean, some funerals are a big deal. You know, maybe you've seen some of the funerals on TV where maybe a king or something dies and they have, you know, all kinds of motorcade and people along the road throwing flowers and everything. And as simple as, you know, a little wooden casket where three people show up and somebody says some appropriate words and the person is interned. You know, and you just don't know. Every person, you know, is different, but every person deserves a respectful burial, you know, and I think that that's that's interesting. But this here, we see just a great detail as far as this barrel goes, and none other like it in the Bible. It says, "When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, 'This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians.' Therefore, its name is called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan." And basically, the place of mourning is the idea there. "So his sons did for him just as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite, as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father Joseph, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father." And, you know, and it's interesting because this whole thing, you know, this whole description of his funeral and everything is really just a unique picture in the Bible. And this isn't necessary. It's kind of a hybrid, if you will, because you have kind of the Jewish idea of burial with the mourning. And if you ever go to and that's not just Jews, but in a lot of different cultures around the world, sometimes when people die, people wail, you know, especially in the Middle East, you know, when somebody dies and they bury them, they actually, at times will hire professional wailers. And the idea is that, you know, you want to know how loved the person was. And so you hire people to cry really loud and obnoxiously, you know, during, you know, to show the deep sadness that you're feeling that they're gone, you know. And then there's other cultures, you know, and they're very quiet and they're very solemn and they don't, you know, you might hear some whimpering, but you know, it's different cultures around the world. But in this particular funeral, you have a mixture of Egyptian mourning period and embalming and all of that and this procession. But then you have just the heartfelt wailing and 7 days of mourning for, which would be typical for a Jewish funeral. And it says, verse 15, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him.' So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, 'Before your father died, he commanded, saying, Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespasses of your brothers and their sin, for they did you evil. Now please forgive the trespasses of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him." Now, this is interesting. Now, if you think about it, it's been 17 years. When his brothers came up to Egypt, they didn't know that this man, remember they called him the man, the man, Zaphnath-Paneah, the second in charge in Egypt, the guy who stood up and blah, 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 through his interpreter, and the interpreter says, "You're spies, and you've come to spy out the nakedness of the land, and you're lying." And they were just completely mortified and in fear, and he takes Simeon and puts him in jail, and just this traumatized group of men, and sent away, and then come back with Benjamin, and then the whole drama unfolds as he tries to keep Benjamin, and finally Judah just comes clean and says, "Hey, this is all my fault. You know, our sin is repaid, you know, come upon us." And then there's this reconnection. And Joseph reveals himself. And it's interesting because Joseph, it doesn't ever say when Joseph was put in blockade to be sold as a slave that he wept. It didn't say that. It doesn't say that Joseph wept when they threw him in prison, but he wept when he saw his brothers, didn't he? He wept when he saw Benjamin, he uncontrollably. And then when he reveals himself to his brothers, he weeps. He weeps for his brothers. He weeps for the loss that was there. And then he weeps for his father when he dies. Never weeps for himself, just for others. And now here he is told, "Your brothers want you to know that your father said." And is he weeping for his father? Is he weeping for his brothers? Or is he weeping because why would they think because they did him a lot of evil, and for sure, I don't know, maybe somebody's done you wrong in your past. And you think about the things that they did to you and how they've hurt you and how they've wronged you. And how if you could just get the chance to show them or to make it, you know, square, or if you could just be able to get in their face and you get, you know, be in that place where you could punish them for the evil things that they've done to you. And yet, you know, they thought, you know, oh, Joseph's just waiting for dad to be gone. And now that the mourning has passed and the funeral is over, now he's going to get his revenge on us. And so they make up this story about, oh, dad said before he died, which he never said. Never said that. They lie. They lie to try to cover up their tracks. They lie to try to protect themselves. And it just says, Joseph weeps. You know, it's been so much loss, so much loss, so much, so many years lost. And now, after being so good to his brothers and telling them, I'm going to take care of you, and giving them this place in the land of Goshen, the city of Avaris, which they grew into, you know, and they it's interesting, even as they look at the city of Avaris, it started with just a few houses, they say between 70 to 100 people, which is exactly how many people came up to Egypt. And then it grew into this huge, the city of Avaris alone, I think, is 40,000 people. And then there's other places that they haven't excavated yet on the outer edges of that. But here they're just concerned. You know, Joseph is going to kill us. He's not going to forgive us. And so the messengers come and deliver this. But notice Joseph's response. He weeps. And then it says, verse 18, his brothers also went and fell down before his face. And they said, behold, we are your servants. And Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? And I think that that is so important for us to realize. Am I in the place of God? You know, when we think about evil that's done in this world, and we think about the wrongs that are committed against people, and you know, when you think about just horrible things, you know, and I don't want to even describe some of the things that have happened to people and will happen to people. And yet, you know, so often, you know, it's the family of somebody they've lost in a horrible way. They can't wait for the day, the closure, not just of the funeral of the person whom they've lost, but the day where they can sit in the little room and they can watch the injection go in for the lethal injection to kill the person who'd hurt them or taken away their loved one. Or you know, back in the day, to see somebody hung or to see somebody electrocuted or whatever it might have been. And yet, you know, you interview those people and it doesn't take away the pain. It doesn't take away, it doesn't solve the problem. And yet there's other people, believers, who have been in that same situation where they've lost somebody because somebody has killed or murdered their loved one. And then that person has gone to the prison, maybe even on death row, and offered forgiveness and prayed for the person who killed their loved one, even leading them to Jesus at times. And this has happened. You know, there's several cases in history where this has happened. You know, one of those cases, of course, was when Elizabeth Elliot went to the Alka Indians and led them to Jesus after they killed her husband and several other men. And you think it's something so contrary to the way we feel, and yet one brings relief. It's called forgiveness, right? True forgiveness brings relief of that obligation we feel that we have to hurt somebody or get revenge. And revenge and bitterness just cause us to continue to be hurt. And yet Joseph sees something much bigger than any of this. He says, am I in the place of God? And I think sometimes we put ourselves in the place of God. Remember what Paul tells us in Romans chapter 12. He says, beloved, do not avenge yourself, but give place to wrath. For as it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink, for in doing so, you will hope heap coals of fire upon his head. It is that forgiveness that you extend. It is that blessing you give instead of bitter, you know, justice that you think you're going to give. It is that that actually brings conviction of the other person. And it's that that actually relieves your soul from the burden. You know, we just think, man, if we could just put a bullet in their head, if we could just knock them out and tell they're dead or something, you know, we think all these things in our flesh, but are we in the place of God? And that's what Joseph is saying. He says, am I in the place of God to bring about justice on you? And why? Well, Joseph recognizes something else. He says, but as for you, verse 20, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. So Joseph doesn't see the situation through the eyes of a man who would seek revenge or justice. He sees it through the eyes of faith. This was all God's doing. God did this. He allowed me to go through that. He refined me through slavery and through imprisonment to make me into the man that I needed to be so that I could save the world. And that's a hard thing for us to deal with in the midst of the trial, isn't it? And yet I think if there's anything that we can learn from this, it is that simple lesson that God works on our behalf and in our lives, whether it's difficult or easy, God is working for our good and for our blessing. And that is a hard lesson to learn sometimes. You know, and today could have been a very different day. I know in Homer, Alaska, Jesse says you can't go anywhere without seeing people weep. They're in groups weeping and shaking and people in his office, you know, breaking into tears because of what they experienced. Now, I know you saw that Homer voted red, but or not Homer, but Alaska voted red, but Homer is blue. They're very blue today. Right? I mean, it's kind of like Sun Valley in Idaho. You know, it is just that culture, that community. People are very upset. And you know, that's the way it is. Sometimes we could have had a very different day. We could have, many people here, now I think probably predominantly, and maybe not everybody, but predominantly people in Emmett have been pretty chipper today for not getting any sleep. You know, most people, you know, not everybody. I'm sure that there's people who are upset about the results of the election. I don't know. I'm pleased in some ways, but I'm also nervous, very nervous. I can't say, oh yeah, my guy got in, because that wasn't my guy, right? That was somebody else's guy, and now he's in, and you know, we don't know what that's going to mean. But you know, we felt maybe, most of us, it was better than the alternative. But ultimately, as Christians, we can't really say, oh, it's good or it's bad. Or, oh, it's good that, you know, this person's in the White House or that person's in the White House. Because maybe it would have been better for the church for the other one to be in the White House. We don't know. I mean, when we think about our country and the future of our country, we have our own ideas as to what would be better and what would be worse. But maybe things won't get better until they get way worse. We don't know. What we do know is that Jesus is in control. And that all things, Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to those who love God and those who are called according to his purposes. And that's where we have to be in our heads. We have to be in that place that God is in control, and whatever happens, I'm going to get up tomorrow and I want to be a witness for Jesus. And maybe today it's legal to be a witness for Jesus, and maybe tomorrow it's not. But either way, I want to get up in the morning. I want to be a witness for Jesus because Jesus has it under control. And even when nations have come in, wicked nations with horrible liberal agendas and awful ways of life and cruelty and slavery and bondage and whatever else have come in to take over God's people, God would still say, you know, I have a plan for you. And it's of good and not of evil to prosper you, not to harm you, but to give you a future and a hope. as he said, it's similar to that in Jeremiah 29:11. It is that idea that God wants to bless his people, and sometimes those blessings don't look like blessings, as it didn't look like a blessing for Joseph. But as everything rolled out, he just looked back and he said, you know what, I see how God used this to save a whole country, a whole group of people alive, to preserve the nation of Israel. And he says, so you meant it. I like how he's candid with them. He's not lying to them. He's not like saying, no, it's no big deal. He says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And that's how we have to look at it in our lives, that God always means it for good. And to have faith in that, the promises of God. And this is true meekness as Joseph does this. I mean, he had the power to destroy them. But he saw it as God removing him that he might save people. He didn't blame them, even though he easily could have. He let bitterness go. Now, therefore, verse 21, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Pretty amazing. Don't repay evil for evil, but return evil with good. So Joseph, verse 22, dwelt in Egypt. He and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. And so probably after Joseph retired, he moved up to Avaris, where his brothers were. They built that castle or palace, and he lived there. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation, and the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And so Joseph lived a long life. He saw three generations of grandchildren. Such a blessing to see that. You know, and so did Abraham. Remember, Abraham had Isaac, and Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob had Joseph and Esau, and Abraham, Esau and Jacob were 15 years old when Abraham died. You know, so you got to see the generations of his kids as well. So such a blessing. And it says, and Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. So he acknowledges that God not only has brought them there, but God will someday visit them again and bring them out of that land. Now, when is that going to happen? In another 300 years, right? Because they're going to be in Egypt for 400 years. That's what God told Abraham. And that's how long they were there. Four generations is what God told Abraham. But they were there for 400 years. So they've almost been there 100 years. He says, God's going to visit you in a future time. And notice this. Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And so probably embalmed, probably mummified, stuck in a coffin in Egypt. And then when the children of Israel will be brought out of the land of Egypt by the mighty right hand of God through Moses and Aaron, they would take up Joseph's bones according to his instructions, because Joseph, as did Jacob and Abraham and Isaac, wanted to wake up at the resurrection in Canaan, not in Egypt. And so they would carry him up. And I love this, because you think about people of faith in the Old Testament, and you got to say, man, Joseph was a guy who really had faith. You know, through the whole ordeal of everything he went through, that guy had faith. And yet when it comes to the hall of faith, the annals of faith of the Bible, Hebrews chapter 11, where it declares by faith the things that people did, this is what Joseph gets. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. That's it. That's all it says about him. It doesn't say by faith he believed that God had a plan when he was thrown into the prison. It doesn't say any of that. I mean, you'd think that they would say something. By faith he forgave his brothers, knowing it was God. No, he just says he told him what to do with his bones. But that's a pretty big thing. Because it speaks of two things. It speaks of one is that God is going to fulfill his promise to bring our people back to the land of Israel. And look how faithful God has been to that very thing. I mean, if you can think of anything in the world that is miraculous, that proves the existence of God, it is the children of Israel. I mean, think about that. Here's a people who were displaced into Egypt, grew into a nation, and moved to the land that God told them to, receiving it from God as a gift, and then driven from that land by the Assyrians and by Nebuchadnezzar, coming back, part of them coming back into the land, some of them still displaced all over the world from the Assyrians, but then coming back to the land from Babylon after being gone for so long under Nehemiah and Ezra, and then being in the land for several hundred years until 70 AD when the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem, scattered the Jews, most of them to Germany, but all over the world. And I think that it was like a third of the population of the Israel was killed in the Second World War under Hitler. A third of the population of Israel, of Jews alive in that day, were killed in the Second World War. Some crazy, ridiculous amount. 6 million of them, specifically there in Germany, killed in concentration camps. Crazy, crazy to think about. And yet God would then take these people who have been out of their land for almost 2,000 years and reestablish them back in their land. And now, after 2,000 years of no nation of Israel, there's all of a sudden a nation of Israel again? That's ridiculous. It blows your mind to think that a nation of people, a people group, could go back into their land to repossess it. Now, what's even more amazing than them going back is that they were still a people spread out all over the world, from China all the way to America. There were Jews, and they were still, after 2,000 years, they were still Jews. And that they could bring them back into the land, and they were still, many of them still practicing Judaism in China, in Ethiopia, in America, and all over the world. I mean, that's miraculous. I mean, how in the world? And so it's not like, oh, Joseph, you know, stupid idea. You let your bones be buried there, and then your people got driven out and never to be seen again. Now you're going to wake up and nobody's going to be there. No, people will be there when he wakes up. To this day, isn't that crazy? And so he gave instructions concerning his bones because he wanted them to be where the people of Israel would be and still are today, after being gone for so long, so many times. It's amazing. And yet, proof of the Bible, because God said, in the last days, I will bring you back into the land. And even the statement is made in Jeremiah, can a nation be born in a day? And it was, May 14th, 1948. Fulfilling prophecy, proving that we're in the last days, as the Bible says. I mean, man, we live in exciting times, not just in our country, but just in the end times, you know. And so to be thinking about that and to kind of whet your appetite for end time study. Let's pray.